The order, record should reflect Senators Halford, Little, and Taylor are present. Being a quorum, first item is Senate Bill 321. I have three people standing by in teleconference in Anchorage, two off-site. Steve Branchflower wished to testify. He has a time constraint. Senator Halford, would you like to give us a brief rundown on the legislation, then I'll turn to Mr. Branchflower.
Thank you, Senator Taylor. The legislation essentially does two things. It establishes a uniform system of dealing with fingerprinting, and it adopts the VICAP program for information on unsolved crimes, which is a national program, hopefully, that will help us in some of the major serial type cases by identifying not just the fingerprint, but the crime print in terms of the commonality and in various things so that crimes can be more effectively prosecuted across the country. That's the basics of the bill. There are two amendments that I think the members have in their packets. One is an amendment that is simply a definition, a clarification of what was previously, let me find the right package here. There it is. One changed the definition and further amplified what they meant by information. That's the Second Amendment. The First Amendment was by public safety and is also supported by the other advocates of the bill and deals with adding violent sexual assaults to the VICAP provision. So with that, I would...
Let me just ask, you offer each of those amendments?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Little.
I guess I would. I don't know that I have amendment number one, the one that you.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. Amendment number one would probably be designated by Senator Halford, lock up in the right upper corner, like this. I think it's attached to number two.
If you'll give me a second to read it, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we don't need to act on the amendments necessarily right now. I was just offering so they'd be on the table, but they need to be part of what we're getting testimony on from the people on the teleconference network and anyone else in the public.
Okay, I'll hold those until we've concluded the testimony. Then it'll give the other members of the committee an opportunity to further review them. Mr. Branchflower, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, sir.
Please go right ahead.
All right. First, let me start out by identifying myself. My name is Steve Branchflower. I want to start off by bidding all of you there a good afternoon, members of the committee and members present. Appreciate the opportunity to address you regarding Senate Bill 321. I have been an assistant district attorney now for almost 20 years, and I am the head of what's called in our office the felony intake unit, and largely my days are spent working directly with police officers, evaluating cases and assisting them in making better cases, and also deciding which charges to bring. Over the years, have been involved in a large number of murder investigations and prosecutions. And as we all know, we've been very busy the last couple of years, especially in Anchorage, an era that has experienced an unprecedented increase in murders. I did a little research here and got some numbers. 1993, we had 17 murders statewide. Five of them were in Anchorage. All of those were under Alaska State Trooper jurisdiction. But within the Anchorage Police Department, we had 31, for a total of 53. So we have all been very busy, as I said. So speaking as a prosecutor, there is a recognition in this era of rising violence that it is important to sort of load our guns, if you understand my meaning, to enable us to go toe-to-toe with some of these criminals. The legislature is in the process of helping us do just that. The conspiracy bill, which the governor just signed, will be a great plus. So the juvenile waiver bill, I understand, is moving ahead. This body now has the opportunity to help prosecutors and police across the state once again by enacting the Uniform Homicide Reporting Statute as proposed by Section 44. Essentially, this amendment will guarantee that police across the state will work with VICAP administrators in the prompt, and I underscore prompt, sharing of important information, because if this information begins when the trail becomes closed. The VICAP is simply an acronym which stands for Violent Crimes Apprehension Program. I understand from Greg Cooper, who is the manager of the federal program, who's also online, they have prepared a short video which they're in the conference room there in Juneau, and Kelly Good from Senator Alford's office told me that because of time constraints, you may not be able to see it today, but I would encourage you, if you do have time, to view it. It lasts about 25 minutes. And the particularly interesting point about it is that it features the serial killer who was arrested and prosecuted in Juneau, Pontiary, and I expect this will be of particular interest to those of you on this committee. The VICAP, I would just like to take a minute and tell you how the VICAP has helped me as a prosecutor. Essentially, the program grew out of the experiences of state and local homicide investigators who some time ago found themselves working suspects who they felt had killed before, but had soon realized essentially there was no national information clearinghouse on the subject in order to compare notes. You'd have similarities in MOs across the country, but there was no one clearinghouse where we could go to or talk to the folks to find out whether or not our suspicions were correct. So as a result of that weakness in the network, several years ago, there was this organization founded called the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime, and I believe it was created in the mid-80s. And VICAP is essentially a national computer data information center, which is located in the what's called the Behavioral Sciences Unit at BIT in Quantico, which Cooper is right now. Essentially, VICAP's mission, as I have come to know it, is to collect and analyze reports of violent crimes, and specifically murder. Essentially, what happens is that they receive written reports from all 50 states and from several foreign countries, and the types of homicides that VICAP deals with generally fall into three categories. You have the first solved or unsolved homicides, or attempted homicides that are apparently random in nature or sexually oriented, or those which appear without motive and are suspected of being part of a series. The second category entails missing persons who are suspected of being victims of foul play. And the third category includes dead bodies suspected of being victims of homicides. And the way it works, that police officers fill out a questionnaire that details all phases of the crime. When I say all phases, I mean just that it includes victimology, the physical evidence, it includes the type of weapon used, the body recovery site, the firearm caliber, similarity and location of injuries, and a whole host of other things. And all of this information is taken from these questionnaires, these VICAP questionnaires, and programmed into a computer, which is then asked to search the database in an effort to find general patterns of homicide MOs. Now, when similarities are found, VICAP personnel, Greg Cooper and his folks, assist local law enforcement agencies in coordinating multi-agency investigations and conferences. Now, we've done this here in Anchorage on a number of cases. One that you folks may recall, which received quite a bit of publicity, was the one involving Kirby Anthony a few years ago, when Mr. Anthony killed his aunt and his two young and her two young daughters after sexually assaulting them. We worked very closely with the VICAP folks and the folks from the Behavioral Sciences Unit there to solve that crime. And much credit for that result, the guilty verdict and that extensive and that long sentence is owing to the folks in Quantico. The nice thing about VICAP is that they are located, physically located, in the same area at the FBI Academy in Quantico as is the Behavioral Sciences Unit. And so what happens is they have access to expertise that each group can offer. I've been to the academy on two different occasions for training, and as I said, I've consulted with them on a number of occasions. In fact, we're working on a big case right now together. In short, the VICAP services provide all of us in law enforcement with especially important tools. I should mention also that their assist is especially valuable if the suspect is thought to have traveled around the country. And this is especially important in remote states like Alaska, where we have a large military presence, We have a considerable number of seasonal workers and tourists, and transients and truck drivers and so forth that frequently move around the country. Now, as you can imagine, the VICAT database can only assist law enforcement officers to the extent that reliable information from all parts of the country are fed into it on a systematic basis, and that's why it's important to enact this legislation that's on the table. Passage of this measure will make it clear that the law enforcement officers and prosecutors in Alaska want to participate nationally and do our share to assist others. I think it goes without saying that accurate reporting will increase the odds for catching a murderer before he strikes again. By the way, I should note that the public safety representatives, who I believe are on net here, have offered an amendment to include not only within the reporting requirement of murders, but the violent sexual assaults as well. And I think that's there to be applauded. I would point out that so far, four other states have passed similar legislation to that which is under consideration. Oregon did in 1986, Idaho did in 1990, Colorado in 92, and New Jersey in 92. So I think there's a growing awareness of the benefits of a VICAT reporting statute, and I wouldn't be surprised if a number of other states enact similar statutes before the end of the decade, because there's a growing awareness of its value. On the question of cost, I understand from Kelly Good that this bill has received a zero fiscal note, which is a real plus. Although I'm not surprised, because the officers around Alaska are already participating on a voluntary basis with the VICAT. What we're talking about is making sure that we have all of the homicides and all of the violent sexual assaults reported, and that to be reported on a quarterly basis so that the information is still fresh. In terms of the form, obviously the design of the form is going to have to be compatible with what is required by VICAT. And I think we're obviously talking about a fairly small investment. So in short, this is needed legislation, and I would urge members of the committee to view it favorably. There is the other part of 321 having to do with the fingerprint amendment, and I just want to close with a few comments about that. Essentially, this proposed legislation would require the taking of fingerprints of those charged or convicted with an offense once they're received in a correctional facility. This makes good sense to identify arrestees and convicts so that we as prosecutors and those that we work with every day, the police, will be on notice of the kind of person they are dealing with, and also to assist law enforcement's detection by increasing the database. You know, we have this very expensive computer that public safety is in charge of, the Alaska Automated Fingerprint System, which is authorized in Title 44. And the database needs to be augmented. The passage of this legislation will ensure that there will be a systematic and a continuous input of additional fingerprints upon which to draw. Unfortunately, I still have the experience of having good fingerprints and a pretty good case, but not having the ability to match it up through the ADESA system. In terms of the cost of the fingerprint part of the statute, I think there probably will be a slight increase in the burden on DOC, but I think it's reasonable to expect some period of difficulty in establishing systems. But I think that once it gets streamlined, I think that the burden will decrease and it will become largely self-executing. I think that covers it for my comments, going over my notes here. Glad to answer any questions.
Yeah, thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate that. Greg Cooper with the FBI, are you online?
Mr. Chairman, could I ask a question?
Oh, yeah, go right ahead. I was just going to try to get through as many as we could before we started.
Go
right ahead. Senator Lumley.
Thanks. Sir, do all places in the state currently have equipment and the capability to do the fingerprinting currently?
I would defer that question to any DOC. Okay. I just don't know. I know that in the equipment that is necessary to do the fingerprinting is not what you call high-tech equipment. It's relatively inexpensive. It's just basically an ink pad and a roller and some ink, and that's about it. We're not talking about a large investment in terms of equipment here. But I frankly don't know. My suspicion is that this is the sort of equipment that you find in police stations across the state or in the village public safety officers probably have in some of the smaller communities as well.
Thank you,
Steve. Mr. Cooper in Virginia with the FBI.
Yes, Your Honor.
Please go right ahead.
Yes, my name is Gregory M. Cooper. I'm the VICAP program manager located back here at Quantico, Virginia at the FBI Academy. VICAP, as indicated, stands for the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program. And our basic mission, in addition to what Mr. Brassflower has indicated, is to facilitate the cooperation, the communication, and coordination between law enforcement agencies around the country and support them in their efforts to investigate, identify, track, apprehend, and prosecute the targeted violent serial offender. Beyond that, the specific services that we provide in support of that function and mission includes providing the National Data Center and Clearinghouse, which Steve has alluded to, for case matching purposes. In addition to that, we also conduct multi-agency investigative task force and major case management consultation and facilitate setting up these task forces around the country. Also, we're involved in research and publication to provide pertinent and very directed input with regard to conducting efficient and effective investigations with respect to this very remarkable creature that we refer to as a serial killer. We're also very much involved in training, both back here at the Academy, in the area of major case management and crime analysis. Additionally, we provide investigative consultations both here at Quantico and in the field, and also provide investigative resources to local law enforcement in their efforts in directing their resources toward these targeted violent serial offenders. Although we are not in a position to specifically support legislation per se, we certainly are from a policy perspective and an administrative perspective supportive of any effort that would generate an increase in VICAP submissions. The success of the case matching capability that we possess is certainly contingent upon the amount and accuracy completion of these unsolved homicides that have been referred to. And right now we have approximately a little over 8,000 cases in the system. It's the largest database in the world, and of course, considering the problem of homicide in this country today, it's a very small amount that we have in the database. On the average, we see about 20,000 to 22,000 homicides per year now.
Can't get a capital punishment out of this committee.
One of the unfortunate observations about that is approximately 69% of those homicides now are going solved, or are solved rather. We had a decrease in our solvability rate over the last few years of almost 30%. And we suggest that much of the reason for this is because of this specific phenomena of the serial killer. It's the stranger type of related homicide where there is apparently no motive, it's sexually oriented, and the offender is specifically characteristic of traveling over county and state jurisdictions. And one of the difficulties that we have in law enforcement is communicating with one another, because we have so many independent law enforcement organizations. And one of the purposes of ICAP is to create an interdependent effort in the communication and coordination between law enforcement agencies in this effort. So we certainly applaud the, from a policy perspective, applaud the efforts in generating an increase in VICAP submissions.
Greg, thank you very much. We really appreciate your taking the time to join us today. I think it's my understanding from the committee members they're probably willing and ready to move the bill, or at least to get on with the amendment process. I know we have several other people here who have provided themselves today as resources for the committee, should there be any additional questions. I might at this time open it up to the committee members to see if they do have questions. We have Dean Guanelli here. We have Attorney Sharp from the prosecutor's office and several others. Of course, Diane Schenker's here from Corrections if you have concerns about equipment or whatever. Senator Donnelly.
I guess the only question I'd ask is, other than the seeking the amendments, is anybody here opposed to this?
Yeah, I meant to ask.
I don't see anybody, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd move. Is it time to move amendment? I move amendment number one here, by the Department of Public Safety.
Well, I had them numbered the other way. We started off with Senator Halford's as number one.
Okay.
Is there any objection on the committee to amendment number one by Halford? Amendment number one's adopted. Go ahead,
just
Senator.
Just to clarify, this would require fingerprinting be done at correctional facilities.
Now, this deals with the specifics of information. If you look, this is page 5,
right, I got it.
And it makes a change and takes out the last part of D and replaces it, and it just makes it more specific. Where it said shall transmit information concerning homicides, it says each report received under and is more specific. That's all it does.
Thank you.
No further objection. Amendment number one is adopted. Senator Donnelly?
Move amendment number two.
Amendment number two has been moved. Is there any objection? Amendment number two, of course, is by the Department of Public Safety. I did have one question, if somebody could answer it, just for the secretary and my benefit, if you would. It says page 5, line 1, insert or violent sexual assault, etc. It does not say insert it where or before or after what. And on page 5, line 1, we have a sentence in progress. The words are within the jurisdiction. And so I wasn't certain where you wanted that portion of the sentence.
Wait a minute.
Senator Donnelly?
I move amendment number 2 as redrafted by our drafters.
Amendment number 2 has been moved as drafted to fit.
What
Senator
does that
Little?
Mean, Mr. Chairman?
That means that the drafter will have to figure out where that sentence properly fits within the sentence it's intended to amend.
Page 5, line 1.
I thought if someone was here that might have... Yes, please, come forward.
That should be page 4. At the beginning of line 1 on page 5. Before, within.
So it'll be after the word committed on line 4? Okay. Is that clear enough, Madam Secretary?
Well, we're still going to check that with the drafter.
We will
sure
check
right.
To make sure it's correct, yes. You'll check that out, Kevin, and we'll report back to Senator Halford, myself, and the rest of the crew here. There being no other objection, amendment number 2 is adopted. Pleasure of the committee on the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Senator Halford.
I believe that the best way to move it is as a CS incorporating those two amendments.
Right.
And if you're ready for a motion, I would move that we pass out Judiciary Committee substitute for Senate Bill 321, including the adopted amendments.
Any objection? That's with individual rec. Any objections? Next item is Senate Bill 266, to extend the Board of Parole. Who is here to discuss? Thank you very much, by the way, everyone who waited patiently for...
And those that we didn't get to because
and
we didn't need
them.
Those
we didn't need. Yes, that's what I meant. Right here.
Chairman Taylor, Senators, I'm Richard Collin, the Executive Director of the Alaska Parole Board, and I don't want to take a great deal of your time, but Senate Bill 286, I guess first the board members would like to thank Senator Taylor for the work that he and his staff have done on preparing some amendments today and for scheduling the bill. Of course, the parole board's been around for the last 30 years since statehood, and has, you know, the board's been reviewed a number of times, extensively in 78 with the new criminal code, and in 86 when Title 33 was rewritten. The two amendments that are presented today, basically, Mike Stark's here to talk about the legalese in the First Amendment to allow one board member to set conditions. And the Second Amendment is regarding extending the board for 10 years rather than 4, and that amendment's offered based on a 1992 legislative audit that said some boards and commissions, such as the parole board, probably shouldn't need be reviewed every 4 years. The governor or any legislator can introduce legislation to change Title 33, and we feel that that's probably enough checks and balances to take care of any problems with the parole board. Again, I don't want to, one correction that I did want to make in the packet that you were given, the sponsor statement on the left-hand side of paragraph 2, sentence 1, states that there's 70 felons on parole supervision, and that's a typographical error at 700. If anybody had any questions, I'm certainly available. Mike Stark from the Department of Law is available.
Mr. Chairman.
Right ahead, Senator Little.
So previously you had mentioned that the members had to be reapproved every 4 years, or are we talking about approval?
No, the members are appointed to five-year terms, and one member is appointed each year. The board falls under the Title 44 sunset provisions of being reviewed every 4 years. Legislative audit does an audit report every 4 years. Legislative audit themselves has suggested 10 years.
So those 4 year audits would continue, the board would be
If it were changed to 10 years, no, the audit would be every 10 years.
Senator Donnelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Earlier this year, I got some communications from constituents complaining about the board trying to discourage victims from coming to the meetings. And so I asked for a copy of the written notifications given to victims, and it seemed the written notifications seemed to be okay to me. So I kind of set it aside, but I do think there's a perception out there that somebody that is talking to people, maybe not in the written communications, but orally, that's.
I hope that's not true, and I'm sure that the board members themselves or their staff aren't doing that. We rely, of course, on institutional probation officers and field probation officers to do a great deal of that notification. We've been encouraging lately, which we hadn't done earlier, teleconference testimony by victims, and I think there was some question originally whether we were going to do that and whether the institutions were going to permit us to do it while we were there.
I just wanted to raise that, Mr. Chairman, because it's a concern that came up earlier, and I don't have any evidence of it. I just have people contacted me and said that was going on. I appreciate that it's not the position of the board to discourage the attendance of victims, and that is helpful if you facilitate teleconferencing to facilitate that attendance. That's good.
Appreciate that. I think that some of us have concern regarding the need for repealers and other sections, of course, at the end of the bill, so as to accomplish your 10-year provision. Is the 10-year matter of that significant of an import? I mean, I
absolutely
think that's
not
very controversial.
Absolutely not. The board has no objection to the 4 years. The only reason that we offered that at all was the fact that legislative audit themselves had suggested 10 years. When the bill was originally written and heard in other committees, it was heard on the four-year basis. And again, it didn't come to our attention until later that legislative audit had suggested 10, so we suggested it also.
Legislative audit doesn't want to do it every 4 years. They want to do it every 10 years.
That's right.
And I don't agree.
Anything else?
Any further questions?
I've got a question.
What's the role of the board in discretionary parole? I mean, I've been a lot of communications from constituents very concerned about people who are violent felons being released earlier than their sentences when indicated on something called, is that discretionary parole? Does the board have a role in that?
Well, there's two types of parole. Discretionary parole, that...
I'm sorry. What I'm really talking about is furlough.
Okay. I'd rather not address the furlough program. I think someone from the Department of Corrections...
Okay, I found it.
That's corrections. That's not...
Yeah. Okay, so it's not... The board doesn't really have a role in the furlough.
We don't have a role in the furlough program.
Okay, that's the one I was worried about. Sorry.
Senator Alford.
Yeah, why are sections 1 through 6 retroactive to January 1st, 1986? What have you done since 1986 that you're trying to fix?
Why don't I let Mike Stark address
Mike
that?
Mike Stark probably needs to talk to us. Mr. Stark, if you'd please take the stand, so
Thank
to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Stark. I'm an assistant attorney general. I serve as counsel to the Alaska Department of Corrections and the parole board. I've done so for the last 14 years. Sections 1 through 6 are intended to fix a loophole which we weren't aware until the last several months existed. As you know, AS 3316 was adopted by the legislature effective January 1, 1986. That was a rewrite of all of the parole statutes. As indicated by the purpose section in the proposed committee substitute, it's been a long-standing practice of the board, which is a part-time board, to have a single member of the board set any supplemental conditions of mandatory parole that are appropriate for a particular offender after reviewing a pre-sentence report, recommendations from the institution based on progress and rehabilitation program, based on input from victims, so such things as sex offender treatment while on parole, alcohol counseling, no contact with minors if the underlying offense is a sex offense with a minor, things of that sort have traditionally been done by one board member, always subject to review by the entire board if the inmate proposed parolee objects to the conditions, and the board itself will then meet as a group. The problem is that, as I said, the board is a part-time board. They meet every few months, but other than that, they don't meet as a group. And the present statutes provide that any decision or order of the board requires a quorum of the board. Board is 5 members, 3 members would be a quorum. And notwithstanding that, traditionally and historically, a single board member, typically in Juneau where the board office is, has been the one responsible for setting these supplemental conditions. There are standard conditions, about a dozen or so, that apply to every mandatory parolee. In the last several months, we've seen half a dozen or more lawsuits being brought by prisoners who are soon to be released on mandatory parole, challenging the establishment of their supplemental parole conditions because it's being done by a single board member rather than the board meeting as a group. It would cost a great deal more money, as I think the information that in the sponsor statement indicates there are approximately 500 prisoners a year released on mandatory parole. And they're not released periodically, they're released every day throughout the course of a year. So to set supplemental conditions or special conditions of mandatory parole would require the board to be meeting frequently. And I think an unnecessary drain on the state's treasury to do that when a single board member is certainly competent to do that, and the prisoner has a recourse of objecting or appealing the proposed conditions to the entire board, which then would review them. So sections 1 through 6 are intended to address that, and to respond to Senator Halford's question, these sections are proposed to be made retroactive back to January 1 of 86, because that's when the statute was first enacted, and to cover prisoners who the law in effect at the time a person commits a crime is the law that the courts have said applied to a person's parole. So we're attempting to go back to the time that the statute was initially enacted and make them retroactive, which will get rid of these lawsuits, hopefully cut back on some of the litigation. And it's not a substantive matter. I mean, we're not talking about the merits of conditions, because the inmates have always had the right to object to the full board and be heard that way.
Primarily procedural aspect.
Absolutely. Exactly. Rather than making clear that it's not required that the board meet as a board to set these conditions, but they can delegate that responsibility to one board member.
And we have pending lawsuits on that issue.
We do. We have a number of them.
Just on that issue?
No, they
incorporate that
shotgun approach, as you well know, with inmates litigation, but that is definitely a significant issue that's pending, actually up in front of the Court of Appeals now as well, and frankly, I'm hoping to moot out the issue by the adoption of this committee substitute.
A further question, some of these things that are in this list, and I should ask the executive director maybe, but these are things that the board may require. I kind of wonder what the board would think about having possibly a short list that says these are the things the board shall require and these are the things the board may require.
Certainly.
For example, not possess or control firearms or other dangerous weapons is something that I'd like to see be a shall require for anybody that's on parole.
Well, in fact, that's the case. We
have
what
work?
We call 13 standard conditions, and that's one of them. The board has administratively through in the AACs has defined the standard conditions. There's 13 of them. Weapons is one of them. Violate the law is one of them.
Alcohol, associate with felons.
Association is one of them, and reporting, residence, employment, all of those kinds of things that apply to everyone that would be on either discretionary or mandatory parole.
Interestingly enough, a number of inmates have challenged. A number of inmates have challenged the board's adoption of a regulation which makes mandatory what the legislature makes discretionary with the board, which is exactly this: adopting a number of these conditions as a requirement for all parolees, irrespective of their
offense. Why don't you give us your list of 13, and we'll put them in the statute, and that'll take care of the problem.
Yeah.
Okay, they're reflected in 22 ASC 20.200. That's the standard conditions
like
of parole.
I would like to see that be. You know, if we could do that in this, it looks like that would work under this title. And there could be a set of whatever the board has adopted as the shall conditions, and then these are the may conditions.
We've used those same standard conditions for 20 years at least.
Kevin, it's 20.200.
Okay. Yeah, good. Well, we'll look that up, and we'll see if working with you, we can devise an amendment here for the bill that will incorporate that.
They will be difficult to challenge if they're statutory.
We want a stall case on standard conditions anyway, doesn't it?
Right.
I mean, that gives us some precedence there.
I think it would help.
A legislative mandate wouldn't hurt either.
No, certainly would.
My suggestion is going to be that we hold this bill till the next hearing or so. It's not my intent to slow it down. I intend to get the thing squirted out of here. But I think there are several questions that we have. I know Senator Donnelly has some additional questions. Senator Halford, I'm sure, wants to review it further. And if you could, Mike, I'd appreciate it. I know you're based here. So if you could, I would appreciate it if you would work with the members of this committee to the extent of dropping by their office, schedule a time when you can sit down and go through this legislation with them so that we can have a greater opportunity to review. I know you're very busy, but it would be very helpful. And I doubt that any other committee is going to give it the type of attention that this one will.
Certainly.
Based on the Senate's face. If you could do that, I'd appreciate it. Anyone further who wishes to testify on this legislation? I not hold it until probably the next hearing or two next year. Next matter coming up, SB 157, prohibited highway advertising. I remember correctly, I think this is Senator Frank's bill, isn't it? There's Senator Frank. We're up on 157, Senator Frank. Oh, fellow from Glen Allen, Jim Ray.
Okay.
Fry? Senator Frank, I have one person standing by on the teleconference. As soon as you're done, we'll take him up, then we'll take anyone here in the audience, and I guess Jeff Otteson.
Okay.
Yes. Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for scheduling the bill today. The major purpose of the bill is to do three things. First, to allow advertising for directional signage for highway dependent businesses. Right now, of course, the federal law prohibits the off-premises advertising or signage on federal aid highways, and in fact our state law goes even further than the federal law does. There is opportunity in the federal law for signage in areas that are zoned commercial or industrial for off-premises signage. And this bill provides an opportunity for that within the federal guidelines, but it is limited, and is limited in terms of number and size and the distance from the business that is being advertised or signed, so to speak. It also, and of course, that is in response to highway-dependent businesses that are frustrated by the fact that they can't get the traveling public, basically the tourists, to them because they can't put a sign up on, even on private property, to direct the traveling public to their businesses. other elements of the bill are in Section 2 on page 3 that put into statute authorization for the department's airspace leasing program, which is a program that this administration has created whereby businesses that are on the highway and adjacent to the highway can lease right-of-way space from the department or from the state of Alaska so that they can put a sign up so that the traveling public can see the sign, because oftentimes you have a very wide right-of-way, maybe 200 or 300 feet, and if they put a sign up on their property, which is adjacent to the right-of-way, you can't see the sign as you're driving down the road because the road is built maybe 50 feet wide or 75 feet wide, but the right-of-way is so wide that there's trees that block the thing and everything. So this is a program that, while it isn't perfect, it does seem to help some businesses. It would put the authorization into statute so that the program will be maintained into the future. The other program that the department has created is the TODS program. That stands for Tourist Orientational Directional Signage, and that's a program authorized by the federal government, and this would put authorization for that into statute. It's a program that seems to work well for in certain situations, and we certainly don't want, we want to put the authorizing statute in there to keep that program operating into the future. And so basically those are the three areas that this bill covers. With that, I'll attempt to answer questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. Senator Frank, I fortunately or unfortunately had the job of writing and enforcing the city of Soldotna's sign ordinance. And I know, well, I guess my question is, would this bill supersede a municipality's ability to have some more strict regulations?
Yes, it would, to a limited degree. It would. It basically says that that a municipality can't prohibit a sign that's authorized in section one. The way I understand it. I believe that is, let's see,
I think it's still controlled by zoning, I think.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it would be, this is only authorized in areas that are zoned commercial or industrial. So you couldn't put up something like this, a sign, if it was an area that was zoned for another use or less restrictive use than, or more restrictive use than commercial industrial.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would like to have an exemption for municipalities who currently have, or for municipalities who wish to have their own sign regulations. I know the city of Juneau has very restrictive sign regulations, and it would be a shame after all the blood that's been spilled on the floors in those municipalities to undo what they've fought over the last years. So I guess that's a very strong concern of mine. Mm-hmm. If we could add some language that would take care of that problem, I'd be willing to draft something or have something drafted that might fix.
Well, I'm willing to consider that. I think it's an important element of the bill to allow for limited signage, and I'd have to go back and think that one through. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'd want to work on that a little bit to make sure that I didn't basically take out the intent of the bill.
Right. Yeah. And I wouldn't want you to do that, because I've had a lot of complaints myself from people who live outside of cities who have no way of advertising their business that they depend on for a livelihood. But, for instance, in the city of Soldotna, we put together very restrictive sign regulations to comply with the state's regs. So I would imagine that some loosening would occur anyway, because the cities would probably loosen up a little bit if this was passed, but I wouldn't want to force them to do that, I guess. I would like for it to be their option.
Senator Halford?
Mr. Chairman, I through the chair to Senator Frank, I'm afraid I feel the opposite way. I think the national sign ordinances came out of the conflict of the Johnson administration and the ownership of TV stations. And they've been a national disgrace in the way they started in the 60s and the way they went forward in terms of what the impetus for them was. I would like to see us have the minimum law that we have to avoid losing federal funds. From that point, I don't mind letting municipalities go on their own, but I don't want to see us mandating anything that we don't have to mandate without the loss of federal funds. I think the restrictions were a massive conflict of interest, in my opinion, when they came out in the 60s and why they came out.
Yes.
Senator Frank, is there a chance that through passage of this bill, that federal funds would be lost?
No. This bill goes not as far as, because we have limits on it, this bill doesn't go as far as the federal law would allow us to go. This bill under current law, we don't have in state law, we don't have the exception allowed in federal law for signage on property that is zoned commercial or industrial. This opens up a window of opportunity, a limited window of opportunity, areas that are zoned commercial or industrial or determined to be commercial or industrial if they're not zoned, allows it to allows you to put up a sign only in those areas, and so it certainly doesn't go in any way, shape, or form beyond what's authorized by federal law, nor was it our intent to even try to do that. So we didn't know of the background that Senator Halford just informed us of, and we were not trying to
your opinion.
We were not trying to jeopardize federal funds or
Mr. Chair. Go ahead, Senator Halford.
Well, with that, I agree with that, and I'm not sure that I totally disagree with your point on what municipalities do. But for example, specific questions on page 2, you talk about they have to be for an individual business entity that is a significant interest to the traveling public, as evidenced by documentation that at least 75% of the entity's gross business receipts are from motorists residing more than 20 miles from the business. Okay, you've got a little store in Glen Allen that's on the road, and it only gets 60% of its revenues from people that live more than 20 miles away. Is there any reason that 75% shouldn't say 50%, or shouldn't say a significant portion of their revenue, or shouldn't say 25%? And is that a question that affects federal funds? The other one that follows right with that is the within 20 miles question. And further on down it says, must be located within 50 miles of the location of the business entity. That one probably isn't as much of a problem for real roadside small businesses because they don't have signs very far away. But I'd like to know what we can do in those particular areas that give these people an opportunity to really have signs out that inform the public as to what's there, what's for sale, and what they can find when they go by, regardless of whether they get 75% of their business from somebody more than 20 miles away.
Well, those are good questions, and Senator Halford, you and I probably agree closely on this. We're trying to, to be blunt, to create an opportunity under state law to loosen these very restrictive laws up enough to provide the businesses that are very dependent upon highway visitors from outside the area. If if you live in Glen Allen and you you go down to the, you know where the stores are if you live there. You know where the businesses are if you live there. If you're traveling in from elsewhere, you don't. And so those are the businesses that really need to be able to put a sign up that says, you know, Joe's grocery store or something. And we're trying to craft something that this legislature will endorse, to be blunt, you know. If we go too far on loosening it up the way you and I might like to do, then we'll lose, you know, the last committee we were in was very concerned about tightening it up, and we tightened it up through a committee substitute. And this committee may be of a different mind, or half of this committee may be of a different mind, or whatever. So I think, you know, to be honest and open, we're trying to do something that's positive and something that's not offensive to the general public, but something that's helpful to the general public, particularly the traveling public, that stays within the federal guidelines, and it kind of makes sense and doesn't open up the thing so that we have, you know, proliferation of signage that some people may feel inappropriate.
I used to love this big sign along I-5 down there just south of Chehalis. It said, impeach Earl Warren, and then the guy would change it to whatever else he liked on his property.
Well, the, you know, obviously...
But yes, you're right. We could change it. I'm very open to changes in terms of the 75% of the business, in terms of the miles. Absolutely. I have no... Those are just, you know... They didn't come down from on high or anything. Those are things that we felt would meet a reasonableness test, and they may be too restrictive or not restrictive enough. But happy to work with the committee on coming up with something that can meet the needs of the public.
Well, as long as the municipalities can adopt their own standard, then I would be for the minimum standard that doesn't lose federal funds in the unincorporated areas. I am concerned about saying that because someone deals mostly with tourists, they have a right to have a sign, and because someone deals mostly with locals, they don't have a right to have a sign. That one kind of...
We passed a bill through this legislature that didn't distinguish between I would be happy, I would not be unhappy. I think that there is a more compelling argument. I don't need that much argument for me, and nor do you, apparently. But some people are compelled by the notion that you have visitors that can't find their way around, and whereas your locals know where things are. So that's the logic, and you know.
I've got a committee in Wrangell that went out and purchased green highway signs built to specs by DOT, and DOT's never allowed them to be put up along their highway, and they say things like this way to the public bathroom, this way to the campground, this way to the boat launch site, and they refuse to allow us, even at our own expense, to put up. I never quite figured out what the delicate ambiance was of a Wrangell highway, but apparently there is something.
Well, again, we're trying to make something that'll work.
Sure.
We have broad bipartisan support on this from people that represent districts that are, you know, have highway dependent businesses, and we've tried to be sensitive to the notion that we don't want a proliferation of billboards, so to speak. But
since I think we're the last committee of referral, Senator Frank, aren't we?
Let's go to finance next or no? Okay.
We'll hold the bill for right now, see if you guys can work out something. But I did want to take Mr. Jim Frey Sr.'s testimony up in Glen Allen, and then I'll get to Mr. Otteson and anyone else here. Mr. Frey, are you on the line?
Yes, this is Jim
Frey
Sr.
Fry. I'm sorry, Fry. Please go right ahead, Mr. Fry.
I live at 1258 on the Choke Road. That's about halfway between Glen Allen and Choke. I have a gas tank, and we do tire repair work. We have lots of information since I've been up here since 1946. We know a little bit about Alaska. What is going on with this sign that comes down from the federal
Thank you very much. I think you'll find what the committee's trying to do here is to go along with your good thoughts there and try and open this thing up a bit. And I think many of us feel just as you do. And I appreciate you standing by and taking the time to out of your life to come down today and testify. Mr. Otteson, did you have comments you wish to make?
No, Mr. Chairman, I've been working with the sponsor. We support the bill. Unless you have a question, I have nothing to offer.
Other than those raised by the committee already, I think what we'll try to do is work with the sponsor and come up with a committee substitute and maybe a handful of amendments that we can work on. And I intend to schedule the bill back up in the very near future, if not next week, certainly the week thereafter, to get it out of here. Anything further? Nothing further on this legislation. We'll then turn to Senate Bill 184. That's again Representative Senator Frank's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I appreciate your scheduling this bill. This bill is designed to remove, just limit the liability of volunteers for nonprofit agencies. I think from a commonsensical standpoint, we're trying to encourage volunteerism. Our nonprofit entities in our state are a very integral part of our culture, of our service delivery, kind of our way of life. We rely heavily on volunteerism, and we're attempting here to limit the liability of volunteers based upon the theory that if you volunteer to go down to serve somebody at the Glory Hole or some other nonprofit agency that's trying to do something to help people, that you shouldn't be held liable for actions that are not, grossly negligent or reckless or intentional misconduct. That's the basic idea. We also require in the legislation that nonprofit agencies to be exempt would have to carry insurance, and that insurance is laid out as at least $200,000 per individual claim or $500 for all claims, unless the nonprofit corporation is a small one, and we define small by having internal operations excluding grants that they might make of $100,000. And is also exempt from the U.S. Code, the Internal Revenue Code. And that's basically it. Obviously, members of the committee are more well-informed on these types of issues than I am, but that's the intent, and I would be happy to try to answer questions that you might have. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Members of the committee, Senator Donnelly.
Is there somebody from Department of Law here?
We have Don Butler, who's here from the United Way. I don't know if there's anybody here from Department of Law.
I just read this memorandum from the Department of Law. It's different than what the bill seems to say.
Yeah.
It says it would not affect the liability of the nonprofits themselves, but as you were pointing out, Mr. Chairman, there's this section that says the liability would be limited to the amount of insurance?
This may have been, we did have a CS, a labor and commerce CS, that I'm not sure whether this is still applicable. If you're reading the April 28th, 1993 Attorney General's opinion,
yeah.
Tell you the truth, I'm not sure if that's still applicable. I don't know.
I've written on a slightly different bill.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, certainly the Labor and Commerce Committee had concerns, and we did limit the scope of the bill in Labor and Commerce to the volunteers, not, I believe I'm right now, not just the corporations themselves.
Yeah, it does look different, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, they added a whole section, the one you're specifically referring to.
Yeah. You know, Mr. Chairman, there's an awful lot of different types of nonprofits out there. I mean, it may sound like a noble thing to insulate them, but I don't know if nonprofits are always somebody I want to have insulated.
Yeah, well, SEAC's a nonprofit. Sierra Club's a nonprofit. Greenpeace is a nonprofit.
I think...
Most people, I don't know that I'm excited about insulating from anything.
I wouldn't be surprised if the American Nazi Party is a nonprofit.
Yeah, I would imagine it is.
I certainly don't want to give a limit of liability to some of the groups that are nonprofits just because they're nonprofits.
Well, perhaps there's those may be good points, and maybe there's a way of more narrowly defining the type of nonprofit that we envision here. I don't know.
Senator Frank, is there, I guess we have someone here from United Way.
Clearly, I'm thinking of the United Way type agencies.
Right, obviously.
Sorry, I did give the extreme example, but I still think it's an accurate one.
I don't know, but it sends a few chills on my spine. Don, did you want to testify?
Not unless needed. My voice is trying to go way out of me.
You're Don Butler, and you represent United Way.
Boy Scouts,
I'm sorry.
Way, mm-hmm. Yes. I think it's from the standpoint of the United Way and of course, my agency, the Boy Scouts of America, we carry a pretty hefty liability policy program as our policy. Awards to within the liability policy, maybe set the limits of liability required a little higher.
It's an interesting capping concept. Don, I'm quite familiar with a case out of Ketchikan, mm-hmm. Involving a pedophile who was Dwayne Sinclair was his name.
That's correct.
I don't want to mention the boy's name, the victim, but I knew the family very well. Mr. Sinclair, I believe, is either still serving time. I think he's still serving time. I think I got a letter from his mother last year asking me to help move him down here to Southeast where she could visit with him more often. I can't remember what the dollar amounts were, but it seems like it was about... $300,000, wasn't it?
Yeah, $350,000 or something like that.
This is for a volunteer who was a Boy Scout leader in Ketchikan, sexually abused this one child repeatedly, and probably several others. The difficulty was he had been tried and acquitted of sexual abuse some years before. I can't remember, 5 years, 8 years, whatever it was. And in between, the police officers in Ketchikan, two of whom I know personally, had notified the Boy Scouts that they had real sincere concerns about him. This came out, in fact, at the hearing, in the deposition. That they were very concerned that in the first case, he obviously hadn't been convicted, but there were still rumors within the community and a lot of concern about what he was doing with young people. Basically, nobody did anything.
Mr. Chairman?
So... I'm only bringing this up because I think it's important for us to realize that sometimes volunteers, big brothers, big sisters have had problems, both in this community and up north. Boy Scouts of America have had problems. The Catholic Church has had legendary problems with priests. Some of these people are, most of these people, are just volunteers who come in, and pedophiles are in fact attracted to certain activities. And I don't even know how we protect ourselves from these folks, those of us that support the activities, which I do too. But I certainly don't want to shield, or don't want to provide a shield for negligent, and I don't think it was grossly negligent on the part of the Boy Scouts not to have investigated him further. I think they may have been negligent in the way they investigated him. But the damages were certainly very real, and probably only a fraction of what the family would actually go through on this. This kid's going to be in, the little kid that was involved attempted suicide 4 different times. He's been in major psychiatric therapy now for at least 6-7 years. They figure he'll be in psychiatric therapy until he's in his 30s if he makes it that long. So, I mean, those are the kind of things I really don't want to shield somebody from. I want somebody standing out there with a pretty deep pocket if they're going to involve themselves in that activity.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I need to go back and understand exactly what the Labor and Commerce version calls for, but I think that we removed employees. I believe that, I could be wrong on that, but I was thinking that we removed the corporations themselves. Or perhaps we just limited it. But I think the focus is on the immunity of the volunteers, and if it, in the case you cite, it seems that that would be clearly at least intentional misconduct. If not, I would assume it would be gross. Well, I don't know.
On the employee, it certainly is. It's criminal conduct. It put him in jail for 8 years. So it's definitely intentional and was proven beyond a reasonable doubt to be intentional.
But the question goes to what was the level of negligence on the part of the association, which may have not been any more ordinary negligence. Unless there was some special trigger, you know.
That particular one is a rather interesting case in that there are still many people in Ketchikan who are angry at the Boy Scouts for taking him out of it, backing him in the trial.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a hard thing to do. But, like I say, I think that it might be of value to up the limit of liability that a nonprofit ought to be carrying. We particularly, for instance, carry a $15 million blanket. But I think it would be of value to consider limiting the liability to whatever the level you would set as a liability. That, yeah. And say that the ladies ought to be carrying that much.
Go ahead, Senator Lund.
I just noticed that this exempts nonprofits operating with a less than $100,000 a year administrative cost. Most nonprofits that I know operate under that. I guess my question is, what's the reasoning there?
Yeah. That was just a suggestion to distinguish between larger ones and smaller ones, and I felt that most would be above that, but
that subsection is an interesting drafting exercise. It's a double negative, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to ask. You get
tried to make it as complicated as possible for this committee, but I may not have achieved my goal.
I think you did an excellent job.
I didn't draft it, to be honest. But.
Are there further questions for the sponsor?
What if it were limited to the employee, not the employees, not the volunteers themselves, not the corporation, not the employees, just the volunteers, and that the standard was as we have it here in D on line 11, page 2.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good approach. I don't really understand what you're saying about B, however. So you're saying that it would only apply up to the amount of liability insurance carried by the entity? Is that what I'm understanding here?
Well, I think the original intent was that, I could have this wrong, but the original intent was that if you're going to allow for some immunity for volunteers or for corporations, that you should show that, I mean, you should require that they do carry some insurance. You're limiting their liability, but you're also at the same time requiring that they carry some insurance. That was the, you know, that was the idea. And so that they would, you know, if they were a large corporate, a large nonprofit, they would have to have insurance. But if they did have insurance, their liability would be limited to the amount of their insurance. And so that you wouldn't have multi-million dollar claims that could bankrupt a corporation, nonprofit corporation. Labor and Commerce Committee took out the employees. And so I think. Just a minute, let me reread that section B there.
They can't be sued at all for ordinary negligence. Corporations can only be sued up to the amount of their insurance.
Oh, right. The amount of the insurance or gross.
Yeah, I guess that's it. You've got it right, I think.
And it requires they have $200,000 in insurance.
Minimum.
So they can be sued up to $200,000.
So are nonprofits currently required to have liability insurance?
They are if they're grantees of the state.
I'm not
sure. The
state
requires a indemnification agreement, and I can't tell you what the limitations are on that because I've tried to get the state to indemnify them instead of us being indemnified by every little nonprofit that's out there doing state work as alcohol counselors or whatever. We do it backwards, which means we put a lot of money into a whole bunch of little insurance agents' pockets, but we don't do much for them.
Fixed commission.
But no, I don't think there is any. I mean, nonprofits is defined here as under 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code. I don't know how many of them are carrying insurance. I can visualize many different situations. I mean, I was just thinking about we've got two nonprofits at home that do run daycare centers, and they have quite a few volunteers that work in their operation. They have salaried people, but then they also have volunteers that come in and help out. And I can just imagine it's Easter time, we're going to dye a bunch of eggs for the kids, and somebody boils a large bucket of water on the stove. She turns and heads out across the floor, one of the volunteers, and she trips. She pours.
Starting to sound like tort class.
She pours it over three kids, you know? All of a sudden, we've got an employee that's totally immune because of this, and you can't sue the nonprofit because that's not gross negligence for her to have turned and walked with this thing. It may have been negligent, but it certainly isn't gross for her to have done so. You basically just tell them, go home. Sorry. That's what's happening. I don't think that's the intent, but that's what the result would be. My concern is that I think we're of two minds, it seems, this year.
We are very concerned that people be individually accountable for their criminal activities, whether it's conspiracies or got the House sending DWI stuff at us, got all juvenile waivers. We're very concerned about individual accountability on criminal law. We also seem to be very concerned to make certain that no one is accountable civilly. Why, I don't know. Apparently it's bad if you're going to do a criminal act, we're going to throw you in jail and hold your feet right to the fire. But if you do a civil act where you damage a bunch of innocent people over here, we don't want multi-million dollar judgments, and I don't want to see somebody going broke, and I don't want higher insurance rates, so we'll make them immune. I think there's probably been a pattern of this. I can think of volunteer ski patrol folks who got immunity a couple years ago, and there's other groups, so you know, it's certainly been done. This one's going to take some work, though, obviously.
Well, I'll be happy to work with you and see if we can meet an intent without causing some harm.
Happy to work with you on it. Anything further on this one? Last bill, Magnuson Fishery Conservation Act. Thank you, Senator Frank.
Thank you.
Resolution number 17. The prime sponsor is Senator Little. Please, you can sit right there. It'll pick you up just fine.
This is a very, very simple resolution, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for allowing the hearing of the resolution. Basically, this sends an important message to Congress to retain, asking them to retain the current geographic composition of the North Pacific Fisheries Council. And it's really vital that Alaska retain our designated seats on that council. And while there are many aspects about which there is controversy about the Management Act, I think this is one thing Alaska can stand fully behind. The CS that you have before you changes some language at the top of page 2. It says we added may consider instead of the previous language, which was will consider or something like that. Then we added 5 names that the resolution would be sent to. And they're in the last section that says copies will be sent to you. I also have a supported position paper that's longer and more detailed in the packet if you want to read it. But basically that's about it, and I urge your favorable consideration.
I note that Mr. Lauber's here, who has certainly been involved in this activity for a lengthy period of time, one way or another, his entire life has been a career involved in the field. Senator, Representative, actually former judge, I should say Judge Lauber, do you wish to make any comments on this legislation?
I'd be happy to. I'm here to answer any questions if you care me to.
You are supportive of it?
Yes, I am. Very much so.
Any questions? Senator Donnelly.
Anybody here opposed to it?
Nobody seems to be opposed. Let the record reflect. Senator Little.
Oh, pardon me. I move that we move from committee SJR 17 with individual recommendations.
Objection. Objection. It moves from committee. Thank you, Judge Lauber. We appreciate your comments.
I wish they all went that easy.
Very concise.
Thank you very much.
You just put this in this year, didn't you?
No. Last year.
I thought it came here in 94.
Have you adjourned?
Not yet. Are we ready to adjourn? It looks like we are. We're adjourned.
We're good.